The White House confirmed that it will now admit 110,000 refugees. Trump's labeled refugees, particularly those from Syria, a Trojan horse. Is this?
If I win, they're going back. They're going back. I'm telling you, they're going back.
Barack Obama made the call to action.
We cannot avert our eyes or turn our backs.
We have to have a temporary ban on Muslims coming into this country. I'm sorry.
Folks say that, well, maybe we should just admit the Christians, but not the Muslims. That's shameful. That's not American. That's not who we are.
I'm Bill Radke. In this hour on KUOW, we are revisiting one of our most emotional stories this year, the global refugee crisis. It has reached historic levels. More than 65 million people forced to leave their homes because of war or because of persecution. World leaders have called it the humanitarian issue of our time. In the U.S., refugee resettlement has become a political flashpoint. The rhetoric has raised questions about newcomers, how many we should bring in, from which countries, what happens after they get here. In this one-hour special, we will hear from some refugees at the heart of this debate. KUOW reporter Liz Jones spent the past year following three refugee families through their first year in the Seattle area. So we're going to meet Netta and Paymon from Iran, who hustle to land jobs in an expensive city. We will meet Osman and his young family from Somalia as they set up a new home here while racked with worry for family left behind in Africa. First, we start with Tutu, a young man from Myanmar who is grappling with English and big choices for his future.
Day one in America at the airport baggage claim.
Good.
Tutu lugs a bag off the carousel. He's 20 years old, playful, smiling, with long bangs and torn jeans. He looks pretty American, but he barely speaks English. Later, he'll tell me that really scared him. How would he get by if he can't communicate? It's a fear he pushes aside. He's not supposed to be a kid anymore. Tutu's cousin, Sheltar, is here to greet him after many years apart. They cry, but they don't hug. That's the culture in Myanmar, formerly known as Burma. Tutu came here alone as a refugee. He'll live with Sheltar, who made this same journey 7 years ago, from a refugee camp in Thailand to Seattle. In the past decade, Burmese refugees have topped the list of new arrivals to the U.S. It's a relatively new community finding its way here. It's around sunset when we arrive at Sheltar's two-bedroom apartment in Kent. Her sister's family also lives here. Tutu brings a total to 9. He'll sleep on a twin bed in the living room. Tutu's his full name, by the way. In Myanmar, you don't use last names. I'm curious to see what Tutu's brought from home. He fishes a picture frame out of his backpack.
Aw, they had a girlfriend.
It's his girlfriend at the refugee camp.
What does it say there?
Forever.
Forever love.
He pulls a Bible from his bag, and then another.
How many Bibles did you bring?
Yeah.
We count at least 4, in his native Karen and in English, a language he's eager to practice.
Hello, friend.
Hello, friend.
Hello, friend. How are you?
That sounds good.
Yeah. And I know you are very tired now. So
that's Cordelia Revels, Tutu's resettlement case manager with Jewish Family Service. An interpreter is also along to help. The agency will help Tutu with his initial resettlement for up to 3 months. They go over small items.
So we have a toothbrush and toothpaste.
And then larger goals.
We'll start working on everything else, like signing up for English classes and looking for a job and learning how to ride the bus. So we will be with you a lot in the next few days.
Tutu nods along to the interpreter. More than anything, he wants to learn English, maybe even be an interpreter himself someday. But he'll also need a job. Decisions like this matter as he sets the mold for his life here.
$20.
For now, Revels leaves Tutu a $20 bill, just for pocket money. He'll spend it in a few hours on a phone card to call his dad back in Thailand. Up until now, Tutu spent most his life in a refugee camp. His family is Karen, an ethnic minority in Myanmar. And for decades, military forces have attacked and burned ethnic villages. More than 1 million people have been displaced, including Tutu's family. Months after we meet, we briefly talk about this with an interpreter. At first, Tutu makes light of it.
While we moved to camp, I carry one chicken, and that's what I remember.
It's a child's memory. He was only about 5.
So it was just sudden. Sudden you had to pick up and leave?
Yeah, suddenly it was a attack. They tried to kill all the Karen people. So then my grandmother had to carry me out.
His grandmother later told him many people died on the way to Thailand. I ask about his other family.
No brother or sister?
No.
They passed away. Yeah.
What happened to your brother and sister?
He says his siblings got sick and died young. His mother left after he was born. In Thailand, Tutu settled into a routine life with his father and grandmother, but it was like living in a cage. And as he got older, his dad pushed him to leave and look for opportunity. Tutu wanted to stay, but he followed his dad's wishes. Now in America, Tutu is starting over again. His youth is on his side. Kids typically adapt easier than adults, but he's right on that line, somewhere in between. Remember, he's just 20. Tutu's first weeks here go by in a blur, full of so many first times. He figures out the bus system and how drivers don't like it if you hand them folded dollar bills or try to get on too soon, and that you fall over when the bus lurches forward.
Get some fish today.
His cousin Sheltar teaches him grocery store 101.
Fresh today, like yeah. The date today. So.
The expiration date, yeah.
Okay, Joy, we do right?
Yeah.
Oh, he asks this one is like expensive. We keep hard.
Does a lot of this stuff look strange to you?
Yeah.
Yeah? Over there, like we eat like fresh. We didn't put in the freezer like that.
Tutu buys some ice cream. But at home, there's a whole pig stuffed in the freezer. So the ice cream goes in the fridge. He meets several times with an employment specialist named Summer.
Let's start by asking him about his education. Did he finish school in his country?
Tutu only got through 11th grade. That'll hurt his job prospects. A key goal of the U.S. resettlement program is for refugees to be self-sufficient and to get jobs in the first few months. Summer pushes Tutu to get a part-time job as soon as possible.
Because he needs to pay bills, the cash he receives from DSHS will not be enough to cover everything. And he said, only education, only school now.
They go around on this a few times.
I don't want to push him. But
for Tutu's first 8 months here, he gets government aid of $320 a month, as long as he's looking for work. It's not much, but it buys him a little cushion of time, and he wants to use it to learn English. It's his cousin Sheltar's advice. She and her husband never had this cushion. They had to pay the rent. And she says it made her feel bad, that maybe her coworkers didn't like her because she couldn't understand English. Tutu can set a different course. It's up to him now to take charge.
I need to sign in here.
This is Tutu on his first day in America, trying to spell his name for a caseworker.
It's almost 2 now.
And here he is 6 months later.
Okay, let's go.
In English class.
That's good.
I take the seat next to him.
Hi. How are you?
Good. And you?
I'm good. Thank you.
Almost since he arrived, Tutu has approached English like a full-time job, and it's paying off. We start to have conversations. I ask what's up with his cell phone.
My phone is not good.
Not working?
Yeah.
Not working. What happened?
I don't know. I send money back. I can't use it.
Oh, okay. That's okay. I call at your house.
Yes.
Appointment.
Yes.
Yeah.
He takes the bus to class about an hour each way, four nights a week. He arrives early, sits in the front, and confidently calls out answers.
Maybe three.
He makes his classmates laugh.
What did you say?
Just kidding.
You make a joke?
Yeah.
Class wraps up, and Tutu heads for the bus home.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank
you. So we'll talk more next week.
Yes. Okay, good night.
Good night.
Have a good day. Goodbye, teacher.
Bye. Have a good weekend.
His teacher says he's well-liked and he works hard. She thinks he'll do well here. Tutu has mentioned before that he'd like to be an interpreter someday, but the odds are against him when it comes to English fluency. In census surveys, roughly one out of five Burmese people in the U.S. say they speak English well. The rest will find their worlds limited in many ways, especially in the job market.
Hi, Tu.
Hi. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
At the 10-month mark, I visit Tutu a final time at his cousin's apartment. Something's changed. He recently turned 21, so I brought him a birthday card. He scratches at the envelope.
You didn't know?
You gave up already? Tu, you should learn to open this.
It's striking how many little things are still foreign to him, like a manila envelope.
Happy birthday. Thank you.
I mentioned that 21 is a big birthday in America, but it doesn't register. I turn to the interpreter.
Do you know why?
Yeah, of course. Everything is legal. you can go to clubs and...
But Tutu's not interested in any of that. His cousin helped him land a temp job with a big manufacturer in Redmond. He solders together electronic parts for $13 an hour. And at work, his conversation skills are expanding.
I know... Hasta mañana. And salud. And gracias. Gracias.
Most of his coworkers speak Spanish. Tutu stuck with English classes for the first 8 months, as planned. But now, there's no more time. His relatives have worked similar factory jobs for years, and perhaps he will too. Compared to all refugees in the U.S., Burmese are among the most likely to stay in low-wage jobs due to low levels of education. But it's still early days for this community here. More success will likely come with time. Tutu seems proud of his job. He helps pay the rent. He's paying off the travel loan for his flight to the U.S., and he sent $500 to his father back in Thailand.
He said that my grandma feels sick. And they need help and they need money. So he sent money.
When Tutu arrived here, his dad told him to only call home every 3 months. Maybe he thought that would make the transition easier. And maybe it did. It seems Tutu has grown up a lot this past year. He's passed into adulthood. He says life here is good. It's not what he expected, but he's not really sure what he expected. He misses family back home and familiar surroundings, and sometimes he'll ask a friend to drive him to a nearby park.
It's kind of far. More like in like a mountain, like, so I can hear like the sound of the river and birds.
It sounds like the mountain village where he grew up, thousands of miles away, and it makes him happy.
You're listening to Upon Arrival, a special about refugee resettlement in the Seattle area. Our story continues after this break. Now, back to Upon Arrival, our special this hour about the challenges of refugee resettlement in the U.S. KUOW's reporter Liz Jones followed three refugees through their first year in the Seattle area. So you just heard what Tutu has been going through trying to make it here. Before we move on to our next refugee story, let's turn briefly to Nikki Smith. She runs the International Rescue Committee in Seattle. She's lived all over the world helping refugees. We asked her about the biggest challenges here for caseworkers who help resettle new refugees.
So the number one biggest challenge is the housing issue. So just trying to find affordable housing is really tough. And we work with a huge amount of partners to be able to identify and locate housing. So then when we have our family in, it's the English is the next challenge, getting them up to speed with their English lessons and really helping them understand the cultural differences between the U.S. and their country of origin.
What should we know about the money they receive as they're looking for housing and dealing with all the other things coming at them in their new life here?
So I would say that it's a lot less than people imagine. People think that they get a lot of money, and reality is they don't. They get anywhere between $800 and $1,000 per person, and that's a one-off payment, and that's all they receive. They also receive some benefits from King County, but the important aspect for them is to get a job. These people don't want to be on benefits. They don't want assistance. They want to be able to start working as quickly as possible so that they can raise money for their families and really supply their families' needs.
That was Nikki Smith, Executive Director of the International Rescue Committee in Seattle. Now let's meet Netta and Payman, a couple who came to Seattle from Iran. In their early months here, they found themselves racing against a countdown clock to land their first jobs. They also hit some surprises along the way.
It's moving day at apartment number 302 in Kent, just south of Seattle. Payman Karimi and his wife Netta hope it's their last move for a while. They left a tumultuous life in Iran 3 years ago, then waited in Turkey, uncertain where their refugee case would lead. The upheaval left them broke and brokenhearted. In this home, the weight of the past will lift and new challenges will surface. But this day is one to enjoy. Netta checks out the kitchen.
So Netta, you're looking at the stove here. It's okay?
Yes.
Her chatty brother-in-law, Reza, lives nearby. He jumps in as our interpreter.
In our country, we don't have the stuff like that. Just work with gas. Here is
electric.
Yeah.
In Iran, Netta trained as a pastry chef and worked in a bakery. Payman steps out to a small balcony. He's still clutching the rental papers in his hand.
$865.
That's your monthly rent.
Yeah. Rent.
So how will you be able to pay that next month and the month after?
I need a job. I like working because I'm young.
Payman worked as an electrician and a welding inspector in Iran. He dropped out of college to make money. Netta and Payman are both close to 40. You often catch Netta with a half smile, half furrow. Her family teases her that she worries a lot. Her nickname is Netta Stress. Payman's got a sweep of dark hair and a playful laugh.
Everything for me is different and change. Country change. Language change, city change. And
Reza teases that even Payman's accent has changed. He sounds Russian.
Okay.
I never see Iranian people speak English like that.
Reza also came as a refugee 3 years ago, and he hands down some advice to Payman.
For first, you have to do anything. Doesn't matter if housekeeping, cleaning, dishwasher. After a few months, you can find a better job and change your job.
Netta and Payman will soon discover this is more difficult than it sounds. Here's a snapshot of Netta and Payman's budget. Together, they get a one-time federal grant of about $2,000 as welcome money, then around $400 a month for up to 8 months or until they find a job, whichever comes first.
Clearly, that doesn't stretch very far. That gets them maybe a month and a half in.
This is Cordelia Revels, the resettlement case manager with Jewish Family Service.
So there is a lot of pressure to find work immediately and just to find any job that can pay the bills.
The U.S. resettlement program steers refugees toward employment and self-sufficiency right away. Various government programs help with job placement for up to 5 years, and the Office of Refugee Resettlement tracks the outcomes. The agency's 2014 report to Congress shows about half the refugees in its caseload found employment. Outcomes steadily improve over time, but the early years can be rough. For Netta and Payman, the job search will not go smoothly. Back in the kitchen, Netta opens drawers and cabinets. I ask how it compares to their last place. Reza interprets.
Her home in Iran was better than here. But Turkey, I can't say it was garbage can.
Oh, yeah. This is better than Turkey.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. 100% better than Turkey.
In the months ahead, I'll never learn exactly why Netta and Payman left Iran. They say it was a lot of things, as we talk one afternoon with an interpreter.
Did anything happen? Like, what? Did something happen to you?
Yes.
Something negative?
Yes,
something bad?
Not for me, but for Netta.
Is that something you can talk about, or?
No.
She doesn't feel comfortable to talk about it because it's gonna bring everything back to her again.
That's okay. I'm sorry that happened to you.
All Netta says is her case is religious. The rest is confidential. The U.S. defines a refugee as someone with a well-founded fear of persecution in their home country. Iran is a majority Muslim country. Religious minorities face discrimination, surveillance, and arrest. Payman and Netta are Christian.
I'm in Kent, outside the office of Jewish Family Service, and I'm here to meet Netta and Payman. Today is their three-month check-in, and their case manager has described this to me as kind of a come-to-Jesus moment. They'll look at all their expenses and the money they have to cover that, and they'll really need to figure out how they're going to make ends meet, especially with some benefits ending soon.
Hi, I'm Alana.
Hi,
Alana. Thank you for coming in. It's really nice to meet you both. So next Monday is the last day of your 90 days, but you shouldn't worry. You have other things lined up that you have applied for. So those are the things that we'll go over when we go through your budget so that you know exactly what to expect after next week.
This is an exit interview. Netta and Payman are at the three-month mark, and that's how long this agency is contracted to help them. It's a gentle push out of the nest. The caseworker checks on how they're adapting. She starts with a softball question. Do you know your address? An interpreter translates.
He knows their address, but she doesn't.
It's really very important that you also carry it with you if there was an emergency or something.
Then the caseworker cuts to the chase. How do you plan to pay the bills going forward? Netta answers.
Payman has to work.
They're both eager to get jobs, but due to a government delay, their work authorization just arrived today, nearly 2 months late. They'd been waiting on that to put in applications. Their savings will last a few more weeks, so the race is on. And that's not all. They got some big news the other day, the kind of news that changes your life and all your calculations. It's 4 months since Netta and Payman arrived as refugees. They're at a doctor's appointment, and let me tag along.
I want to feel your tummy, okay?
The doctor pulls out a tape measure.
You're 21 weeks. Some people don't start feeling the baby until they're 22 weeks.
Yep, there's a baby on the way.
Good? Okay, we'll see you next month, okay?
Thank you.
If you need anything, you know where we are, okay?
As we walk out, Payman, in his playful way, leans over Netta's shoulders and practices for the big day.
Netta, I'm here. Don't worry, I'm here.
This baby lights them up with joy, and also with an urgency to get some things in order. Their first months did not go exactly as planned. Rent is higher than expected, and they hoped for jobs right away. In Iran, Netta was a pastry chef, and Payman set up telecom networks. But here, it took 3 months just to get social security cards, something most employers want to see. Payman was stressed, but tried to keep up Netta's spirits. This journey had been hard on her. She cried a lot. Then, a couple weeks back, they turned a major corner. They both landed their first jobs at one of the most all-American places around.
So up here you see the orders come in.
McNuggets and one McChicken.
McDonald's. Paimon tends the fryer. Netta assembles sandwiches.
Onion crispy. Yeah.
Crispy onion.
Crispy onion, yes. Bacon, cheese.
Paimon jokes that he's put on a few pounds.
That's too bad for me.
Most days, like today, they work side by side. That way Paimon can help Netta with her English. It's no coincidence they found this job. Lots of Iranians work here, says their manager, Mosh Zadeh.
Yeah, I have pretty much about 20 of them working for me.
All from Iran?
All from Iran, yes.
Is that, are you Iranian also?
I'm an Iranian as well, yes.
It's kind of a network.
It's kind of a network. I have about 14 of them working for other McDonald's as well.
He hires refugees from other countries, too. These jobs are a humbling step down for Netta and Paimon. Zadeh sees that a lot.
I've had people that were engineers back home, for instance, but for now they had to work and hadn't have an income.
Netta and Paimon earn about 10 bucks an hour. Data show a refugee's income tends to steadily increase over time, but it's gotten tougher, and today's refugees are not making the same gains as those who arrived in the 80s and 90s. A recent study from the Migration Policy Institute suggests several reasons for this lag. The recent recession, an influx of new refugees with low education, and minimal levels of support for them upon arrival.
Hamburger patties.
Yes, hamburger patties.
Paimon says he gets along well with his American coworkers, except this one time, another guy yelled at Paimon for doing extra chores all the time. He said it made others look bad. That guy got fired after a couple weeks. And some customers get impatient with his English, so he practices in his downtime.
Hi, how are you? What do you do today? Oh, rain is coming.
It's a good job for now, but soon Netta will be home with the baby. Paimon's income alone will not cover the rent. Something's gotta change.
It's a hot Sunday afternoon, and I'm out at Paimon and Netta's apartment in Kent. I think they've been up since about 8 a.m., packing boxes and just cleaning out their apartment.
7 months after they arrive, Netta and Paimon are on the move. The last thing to pack up is a bonsai plant that Paimon likes to talk to.
I say, I love you. You are the simple of the life.
Where do you find this plant?
At the IKEA.
A friend helps carry the boxes to the parking lot. They've decided to move to Palm Springs for several reasons. It's sunnier, and Paimon has cousins there who can help him find a better job. But a huge factor is the cost of living. Their new rent will save them a couple $100 a month. It's common for new refugees to relocate. Seattle's become a popular choice for the $15 minimum wage. Officially, this is called secondary migration, and some experts say it's an overlooked challenge in the resettlement process because people move around, but their support services don't. Paimon is optimistic about what's ahead.
I'm feeling happy. I'm feeling excited. I hope to take a good job, and maybe I will buy a home for my family. Not for me.
And in 5 years, he says, they can be citizens, Americans, not refugees.
Trunk is full?
Yes.
They'll drive south in an overstuffed gold sedan. A Ukrainian immigrant gifted them this car and said, pay me when you can. Paimon says mostly they've felt welcomed here, but there have been a couple odd encounters, and one happens now as they pack up. For nearly an hour, a young man with a shaved head stands 20 feet from the car, arms crossed, intently watching. We all just sort of ignore it, and the guy eventually leaves. It's sundown. The car is finally packed. Netta, 7 months pregnant, takes the passenger seat with a laundry basket on her lap.
Let's go.
Paimon says goodbye to his friend and slides behind the wheel.
Bye, Netta.
It's a movie moment. There's a sunset, they're driving off, and an ice cream truck rolls by. Oh, and by the way, it's a baby boy. They name him Nathan, Nathan.
You're listening to Upon Arrival, a special about how new refugees get by in America. During his campaign, President-elect Donald Trump called for extreme vetting of some refugees, particularly those from Syria and the Middle East. Sarah Peterson is Washington State's refugee coordinator. She says less than 1% of refugees ever get resettled in a third country, and the vetting process is strict.
So the U.S. refugee admissions process is completely administered by the federal government. It begins with a referral from the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, and they refer a very small percentage of all refugees to the U.S. And they conduct a very extensive screening process that begins with a in-person interview from a Department of Homeland Security officer. And then it goes through a security clearance process where I am no expert on this process, but I understand that they go through many, many different databases to verify identity. For many, that process can be as quick as 18 to 24 months. For others, it can take years, if not decades, to get into the United States.
How much danger is there to the United States from refugees? And what can you do about that danger if it exists?
It is my understanding and in my experience working with refugees that many of these people are only looking to start their life over. Most of them never anticipated being able to come to the United States. And it takes years to get here. And the likelihood that you are able to come as a refugee is a little bit like winning the lottery. Less than 1% of all refugees worldwide ever even get selected for refugee resettlement. And the timeline it takes for people to come into the country is so extensive that it would be really difficult for someone who is intending to do harm to the U.S. to be able to come in.
That was Sarah Peterson, the refugee coordinator for Washington State's Department of Social and Health Services. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, our final story about a Muslim family who came to the U.S. as refugees looking for peace. I'm Bill Radke. You're listening to Upon Arrival, a one-hour special about how new refugees in the Seattle area adjust to life here and the hurdles they face. For many, the trauma of their past cast a long shadow. It's estimated about 1 in 3 refugees experience mental health issues due to violence, displacement, and loss. In our final story, we meet a Somali family struggling to be okay.
So, can you say your name?
I'm called Osman Mohammed. I'm just a refugee. I ran from my country since back 1993, and I just came to Kenya for issues of security and protections.
Osman will give this introduction many times during his early days here as he seeks help for his family. Here, he's talking to a social service provider.
United States of America, and I'm just...
Osman is 27, tall, slim, polite. He spent most his life in a refugee camp and arrived to Seattle ready to charge forward.
While I came to U.S., I thought that I stepped on the paradise step. I found the peace country. I love it, and absolutely I wish to get as soon as possible to be a better life.
He wants to be a pharmacy technician someday. But on this day, after about a month in America, he's at a Somali nonprofit in crisis.
How kind of a challenge I'm having, guys. What am I supposed to do, ma'am, while I'm new?
So what happened? Tell us about the story.
Absolutely, ma'am. Let me just tell you all of this, you know? Like, while we just...
Osman's been dealt an unusually tough hand here. He witnessed a crime a few days back. It seems to reopen old wounds and throw him into a familiar tailspin of panic. Once again, just like so many times in Africa, he's wondering, how will I survive?
You ran out that way.
No, come on, I'll show you where I ran to.
Later, Osman shows me what happened.
You see?
We're outside his apartment, his family's first home in this country.
On Friday, there was killed a man here. On Friday.
Right here on the sidewalk?
Right here.
You saw it?
I saw it. I saw the man was being shot. Take for the pistol up like this. Pop, pop.
A gunfight erupted right outside their porch. Osman was taking out the trash. He dropped it and ran. His wife and young daughters, ages 2, 4, and 5, watch from the bedroom window.
My kids, they saw the blood. They saw the cops. They were being crying. They were not knowing what to be done.
A few days later, another shooting right outside. Osman's family refuses to stay another night. As he talks now about this ordeal and in the weeks ahead, Osman thinks about his daughters. He's still haunted by violent memories from his own childhood. Will his girls now go through that too?
They even told me that, Dad, we are not going back to our apartment. We will be dead if we go there.
Your girls say that.
Yeah, the girl says that.
We ran from bullets in Africa, Osman says, and again, we find bullets here. Osman was about 4 years old when his family fled Somalia's bloody civil war.
We ran from our country because we were being discriminated a lot. We were a people who were just a minority tribe.
Brava. What is it? Oh, Brahma.
Yeah, Brava, Brava.
Brava.
Brava, yeah, yeah.
In Somalia, he says his tribe is treated as the lowest, the worst.
In Somalia, even some people, when we are just a person to them, they do like this. They don't like us.
They put their shirt up above their nose?
They make us like we are smelling.
That's far from the worst of it. He says the clan warfare was constant.
24-7, no one day rest. There is not a one day single rest.
A scar behind Osman's ear traces back to that time. His mom refuses to tell him how it happened, but Osman knows it's connected to the day his younger sister died. He says hostile men attacked their home. They raped and killed his sister and his aunt. His parents fled to a refugee camp in Kenya, where they still live, 2 decades later, in a precarious situation. Somalis now make up one of the largest groups of refugee arrivals to the U.S. Seattle is home to the third largest population.
Go straight.
In the months ahead, when I talk with Osman, I'm struck by how his emotions often overtake him. Little things trigger his thoughts of Africa. Like this one rainy day, in the car, he's giving me directions to an appointment and starts to cry about his parents.
I'm still challenging with my kids. I still remember my parents. I'm not sleeping well. Too much worrying, too much thinking back with my parents. What's going on with them, you know?
This will be part of Osman's challenge as he tries to set up a life here. He's torn between his future and his past. He's struggling to provide for his children here and racked with guilt and fear for his parents in Africa.
My father, my mom, they're not.
He worries he's abandoned them in a desperate hour. The Kenyan government wants to close their refugee camp, and his parents may be forced back to Somalia.
What did you think it would be like when you got here to America?
I was told that I'm in paradise, you know? But I found that still. And I hope that I will forget for the past consequences what I have been passed in my country.
It's hard to hear, but he says he hoped he'd forget what he's gone through in the past. Somehow, he seems to feel it more. He pulls up the collar of his jacket to wipe his eyes. The U.S. considers it a public health priority to provide mental health services for new refugees, but there are many barriers to care, including cost, accessibility, and cultural differences. Osman says he's never talked to a counselor about what he's been through. After the shootings outside Osman's apartment, his family stayed with other refugee friends for several weeks. Eventually, they got a new apartment in Federal Way.
Hi. Hi, is your daddy here?
Yeah.
Osman?
Yeah.
Yeah, Baba.
Hi.
Osman's three daughters let me in.
Hi. Oh, thank you. You're taking my hand, pulling me inside.
It's Osman's day off work, and he slept in.
Today was my off day. I was just relaxing. Oh.
5 months have passed since they arrived. Osman seems more at ease. His wife, Rama, has just made injera bread. The girls sit on the kitchen floor to eat it.
They like to eat on the
floor. Yeah, they like to eat on the floor because they are still on the life of a refugee. Yeah.
They've had other setbacks since they arrived. They've moved four times, and a car hit Osman in the crosswalk, then sped off.
The car just hit me and ran from me.
He shows me the hospital bill.
Okay, I'll show you.
But he's got a job now, washing dishes at a large bakery. It's a long bus commute, 2 hours each way. Plus, a Muslim nonprofit is helping with their rent for the first year. Things are looking up.
Grandmother's calling, she said.
That's the grandmother calling right now?
It's Osman's mom, calling from the refugee camp.
Hello, hi. Halmarsuk. Halmarsuk.
Yeah?
Halmarsuk.
As they talk, Osman buries his head in his hands, crying. His father is having more health issues.
No help.
No help at all. I'm here.
I hear you.
His daughter touches her small hand to his cheek. Osman says sometimes this crying scares him, makes him feel dizzy. He'll just be crossing the street and it hits him. His wife says she's never seen him cry like this. A little later, we take a walk outside.
Did you see this Starbucks?
Yeah.
Osman is laughing, smiling again, and philosophical about life.
So sincerely, if I told you the truth, Lizzie, you know, you cannot achieve or reach your aim if you don't struggle. So now I'm struggling.
And he's okay with the struggle. Because here, there's also hope that he can heal and move forward. And that's something he hasn't felt in a long time.
This was the final part of our series, Upon Arrival. And you can see Osman and his daughters, and incredible photos from the entire series at our Facebook page, KUOW Public Radio. Our social media producer, Bon Huberman, is here. Bon, we've seen a strong response to those photographs.
Absolutely, Bill. I think people are really moved by this story. Ray told us, if this doesn't hurt your heart, you might not have one. Magdalena tweeted, I hope this family finds peace soon. And others kind of found a more personal chord. Nina wrote on Facebook that she arrived in the U.S. in 2001 with, quote, similar hopes of finding peace after being a war refugee for nearly 10 years. On 9/11, my hopes were shattered. But then there's a more hopeful note from Alawash, who responded to Osman's kind of sentiment that he thought the U.S. would be paradise. And Alawash says, it will be paradise. Work hard.
Thank you for your comments. You can go to our Facebook page yourself and add your own thoughts and your own story. We are KUOW Public Radio. Now, thankfully, not every new refugee faces struggles as tough as Osman's, but even the daily challenges of adjusting to a new life in America can be emotionally hard. Andrew Kritovich knows that better than most people. He is a refugee himself. He's from Ukraine. And he counsels refugees in his work with Lutheran Community Services Northwest. Andrew told me when he first got to America, just buying milk at an Albertsons in Kent was almost more than he could handle.
We came to U.S. and our relatives, they were here for about 2 years before us. So they were really experienced in life in the United States. So they said, okay, you will receive coupons in the mail. So you can cut those coupons, go to the store.
Coupons.
Yes, yeah. And got stuff cheaper. So we got those coupons and we went to store. So we grabbed the milk, we went to the register. And person on the register, he was trying so hard to explain something to us. And our level of English, I have little British level of English. It was enough to say a few sentences. But when people were talking back, it was like one huge word without beginning and end.
Mm-hmm.
So I was only saying, milk coupon. And he was like explaining, milk coupon. And he stopped, he said, wait, okay? And I'm like, okay. So he ran to the back of the store, grabbed correct brand of milk, gave it to us and asked, okay, And I'm like, okay. And although, yes, it's kind of very simple task, right? When we go to store and we just buy in a milk for people who are born in the country or live here for a long time. But for new arrivals like we were when we came, any simple task was really hard. And even after that, I went home and I had almost emotional breakdown. I said to my wife, I didn't have kids at that time. So I said, at least before I knew how to buy milk. And now I feel I have no idea how to do even simple stuff. And that's what many refugees, they are going through this. Whatever is very easy for us, or relatively easy, it's unimaginably hard for newly arrived refugees.
We were just listening to this story about Osman, learning how hard it can be to leave some difficult memories behind, some struggles in your past. How can these emotional struggles affect the goal of settling here in America?
Very good question. For many of us, when we meet refugees, many of us can think, great, now you must be happy, you're in your country. But for refugees, it's impossible to release this experience. It's
to release
still
it.
There. Yeah. Absolutely. It's still there. It's still hunt people. And many refugees, they're still in survival mode because of what happened. And same person is coming to the office and saying, oh, my right shoulder hurts. And at first we would think, oh, it's a medical issue. But then you ask, tell me more about this. And person is saying, I always sleep on my shoulder and I face the door. And then person is saying, and I understand that I'm here in the United States, but I feel I need to have knife by me under my pillow because I'm afraid that they can enter through the door. They can hurt my family again. So although people consciously, of course, understand that they're here in United States, but it's really hard to deal with this emotionally when you're really emotionally affected, when you clearly remember how it happens and people are reliving this situation and people are trying to resolve it. But that's why many times we need professional conversation to really help people. Although many times it's easy to say, and it's not easy to do.
Yes. You're working as a mental health therapist now, Andrew.
Yes.
How do you do it? What do you do to help refugees process these kind of challenges?
First, and probably what is most important when we meet newly arrived refugees, we're really trying to normalize experience. We're really trying to say whatever you experience, it's a normal reaction to very abnormal situation. Because many people, when they come in and they have those emotions and they consciously know I'm not there anymore, but emotionally they are still there. And many people can think, am I crazy? What's going on? What's going on with me? So we're trying to really normalize it. We're trying to really say whatever you experience, it's very normal human reaction. There is nothing wrong with the reaction. Situation is wrong. Because people usually don't talk about this. People casually don't talk like, oh, you know, I cannot sleep and I sleep only 1 hour. People try to hide this. But when they hear, okay, other people experience this too. And then, of course, it's also important to resolve immediate stressors people have, stressors of adjustment. And when we address these issues holistically, we see improvements.
Andrew, we talked about your having an emotional breakdown yourself early on. Was there a turning point for you when you felt like, I can do this?
Starting my first job, where I really received the sense, I can do this. I can be also part of this society. First work, it's unimaginably important for many refugees. And majority of refugees, they really looking for this hard. I want to work. I want to have job. I want to be useful. I want to provide for my family. And actually, my first work was a security officer here in Seattle. And it was great experience when I learned, yes, I can provide. Yes, I can also learn and do something.
I'll bet there are people listening to you right now who would like to help. What could people do in the Puget Sound area to help refugees resettle and live a fulfilling life?
What I would say, first of all, bringing awareness, helping on a level I can. I remember when we were going through this process, we had a lot of people we didn't know them, who just smiled in the right time, who provided help in the right time. And from all those little events, refugees, people who come in from bad situations in the world, they feel accepted. So we can all feel as part of one community. And we really trying hard to bring refugees to level of self-sufficiency. Many success stories were refugees who were coming here just with two bags, but with a lot of hopes. And they achieve a lot in life.
Andrew Kritovich, a former refugee here from Ukraine, is now the program director of the International Counseling and Community Services with Lutheran Community Services Northwest. Thank you for spending the last hour with us. I'm Bill Radke. KUOW's Liz Jones reported these stories. Carol Smith is our editor. We got production help from Matt Martin. This has been Upon Arrival on KUOW.